From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Richard Luttendress, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Tensions continue to rise in Eastern Europe after an aggressive Russian attack on and seizure of three Ukrainian ships off the Crimean Peninsula earlier this week. Fears of a military crisis there are growing. President Trump, citing the Black Sea incident, has canceled his planned meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at this weekend's G20 summit. Leaders of the world's biggest economic powers are in Buenos Aires for the summit, discussing issues from trade to climate change. A new government in Mexico is trying to negotiate with the United States over how to address the latest caravan of Central American migrants who are attempting to cross the border. And President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, has pled guilty to lying to Congress about a planned Trump company project in Moscow. We'll discuss what this means for the special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. We'll end with Russia, and we'll start with Russia and what happened the beginning of the week. Richard, bring us up to speed. This was an attack by the Russian military on three ships right off the Crimean Peninsula. Tanks, the Ukrainians are now saying, are mobilizing Russian tanks on the border. Where are things right now, and is there any possibility that they could cool down?
At this very moment, it doesn't sound like this. We are in a situation where the Ukrainian vessels are still held by the Russian army. 24 crew members we've read that they're imprisoned in Moscow. They've been moved mm-hmm. to Moscow. The interesting thing is that it's an interesting conflict that we haven't talked much. So many things seem to be happening all over the place that we've kept our eyes away. We've pushed our eyes away, but there have been tensions along the borders, and the Russians have kept supporting the secessionists, the rebels in eastern Ukraine. This is, you know, just a follow-up of big tensions in the area, Crimea being occupied by Russia since 2014. And so the Russian vessels trying to reach the Sea of Azov, the Ukrainian vessel trying to reach the Sea of Azov, it's just a geopolitical reality that Russia remains assertive in its way of saying this is the way it's going to be from now on. It doesn't matter the sanctions from all over the world. We control the area and Ukraine stays on its side.
And Emily, there's been a question about what, if anything, the United States might do in response to this. We heard at the beginning of the week a pretty strong rebuke from the United Nations ambassador, Nikki Haley. Of course, by the end of the week, we heard from the president himself saying in his own particular way that this was bad on the part of Russia and Vladimir Putin, and he wasn't going to meet with Putin as a result of this. Will the United States, will NATO do anything about these tensions that are rising in this part of the world?
Maybe. Right. I think that we're still not sure. It was interesting that the president gave the seizure of the Ukrainian ships as his reason for canceling his meeting with Putin, given that that meeting was announced after the ships were seized. Right. And given that the president took over 24 hours to respond to the seizing of the ships. And when he did, said, we don't like what's happening either way. And given that Ambassador Haley did condemn what Russia did and did say that the U.S. stands with Ukraine, but also said that we expect our European partners to take the lead on resolving this crisis. So what the U.S. role will be, I think, is still very much to be seen. Maybe there will be new sanctions specifically over Ukraine, right, because these vessels were seized. But as Richard says, that has not yet gotten Russia out of Ukraine.
Right.
This maritime moment was the latest in a series of escalations that have been going on at least since May. International attention and condemnation hasn't seemed to stop that. And the other thing is that, you know, the U.S. has so thrown itself in with Ukraine on this, which is in keeping with U.S. policy and U.S. position. But another component here is that Ukraine declared martial law, which is pretty unprecedented given that they didn't do that in several more violent episodes that happened with Russia in their country. That's a big deal because we have presidential elections and not too long, and they're supposed to be in March. So Ukraine and President Poroshenko is clearly trying to drape himself in the flag and in camouflage on this one, right, to make this a political cause as well. And whether the United States under this administration is going to carefully watch what that martial law means. It's imposed on roughly half the country right now. If it is indeed lifted after the 30 days, if it affects the elections, you know, if the democratic and rights component is still upheld in Ukraine, that we need to still keep an eye on as well.
And we'll return a bit to the question of the Putin-Trump relationship in this canceled meeting. But Richard, quickly, this is an administration in Washington that has sort of had to be dragged kicking and screaming to sort of side with what Emily just described as U.S. policy, defending Ukraine against Russian aggression. Really, this was an effort by members of the president's own party in Congress to pull him over the line to get these new sanctions over the last couple of years. Does this change anything from the White House's perspective?
Well, just going back to the words of the president this week, when he was saying he was not happy, it was not a good thing, it's a major event.
It stuck out, didn't it, those comments from the president?
You know, it was hard for him. Listening to Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, they were stronger,
right,
harder in the words they were using until, and it's very interesting because when the president, before leaving for Argentina, said that, yes, he's going along with the meeting Vladimir Putin in Buenos Aires and talking about trade and other issues, Ukraine was not seriously in the picture. It just brings us back to the president, very mysterious relationship or mysterious attitude towards the Russian president. Another precise occasion where he could have been more straightforward in saying that American interests, but also American traditional politics in similar circumstances would have been to put pressure on the Russian leader. The president has so much trouble, looks like he has personal problem attacking or being straightforward with the leader of the Kremlin.
We're in the midst of the G20 summit in Buenos Aires. There's what's happening in Russia. There's obviously what's happening in the Middle East as well. There is the leadership of both Saudi Arabia and Turkey in Buenos Aires. All these tensions throughout the world. What can we expect out of an economic summit dealing with issues like trade, like the environment, when you have these sort of geopolitical tensions that seemingly at their highest in a long time?
Well, this is the thing, right, is that there is a lot of serious work that needs to be done. And some of that work will not be done because we have tensions between various members of the G20, right? You pointed to not only because they won't work together, but just because it's, I don't want to say political distraction, but it is. It's a distraction from the trade issues or the economic issues that they're ostensibly there to discuss. Argentina, in setting this up, tried to make it sort of as when they set up the priorities, they did not make climate change one of them, for example, right? So we have infrastructure, we have gender mainstreaming, we have food security, we have issues that everybody should be able to just come together and issue a proclamation on, right?
Should be, exactly.
Like they are, the host country did what it could here to make sure that everybody was able to sort of play nice in the sandbox for however many hours. But the potential for gaffes and for anywhere from gaffes to geopolitical crises, right, is truly
at the very basic roadblocks, right, to getting
absolutely
to any sort of agreements,
exactly,
because of these political roadblocks in between. Richard, talk a little bit about what we haven't mentioned regarding this G20, which is the relationship with China, between the United States and China and the rest of the world. Tensions over trade, over these issues, arguably haven't been higher in several years. What can we expect to come out of this with this largest economy in the world?
It should be a big moment, Michael, because, you know, we are reaching a point where, according to what the administration has decided, come January 1st, there's a new set of tariffs falling onto $200 billion of Chinese imports in the U.S. up to 25%. It's a lot of pressure on trade relationship. There are different options. If Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, because it has reached a point with this administration that a good personal conversation can end up having a huge impact on the follow-up commercial and economic relationship between the two countries. So if the president comes out of his, it sounds, it looks like he comes out confident out of his meeting with Xi Jinping, well, he could get rid of the tariffs, keep them at 10%, or bring them even higher if things don't go well to tariffs on $500 billion. So we've reached a moment where I think it's going to be a very interesting summit. And for me as a Canadian, I look back at the humongous failure that the G7 was in Charlevoix in Quebec last summer, where they couldn't even agree on a common communique. I think the G20 is probably a better, even if the Argentinian president has managed things in such a way that to avoid big disagreements, I think we have a good opportunity to at least find a way to come out with an interesting conclusion or agreement on something, not covering the entire planet, but side bilateral agreements on the sides.
Well, and as well, regional trade agreements, the new NAFTA, as the Canadian Prime Minister refers to it, the USMCA, as the American President refers to this new trade agreement among the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Anything, either of you, that we should know about this new agreement as we see it being brokered between these nations?
Well, it looks for, on the Canadian standpoint, it's just an agreement on a little tweaking of what was NAFTA. We agreement on cars and on milk that affects us. But in the end, the decision of GM last week of decision to cut 15% of its employees, and it looks like the agreement doesn't have an impact on this type of decision in the end.
Right.
And the tone of the Mexican president is to say, well, small little changes, not much.
Emily, quickly.
Yeah, our president, the U.S. president, can call it whatever he wants, but the reality remains that the bones of this agreement are NAFTA, right? This was an update of an agreement that granted was outdated just because of when it was brokered in the first place. But yes, as Richard says, it's NAFTA. And whether getting these changes with the tone that the U.S. administration did, right, was worth whatever damage just happened to the U.S.-Canada relationship in particular, whether that was worth it, that's for the Trump administration to decide.
Well, after the break, we'll discuss a different relationship between the United States and Mexico right after this break.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And while you're there, check out our other programs, Encounter and Press Conference USA. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Emily Tamkin, Foreign Affairs Reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Richard Latendresse, Washington correspondent for TV8 Nouvelle. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Emily, we saw this week the caravan of Central American migrants that had been slowly making its way through Mexico toward the United States border, actually reach the United States border just outside of San Diego, California. There was a skirmish. There were rocks being thrown. There was tear gas being thrown on both sides of the border here. Things seem to have calmed down a bit after this incoming government in Mexico brokered a tentative agreement with the United States. Bring us up to speed. Tell us what exactly is happening, and can we expect some kind of resolution that's relatively peaceful to deal with these immigrants?
We cannot expect a resolution. And the reason for that, I mean, there may be momentary calm, right? But this president has made immigration through the southern border a major issue. Immigration is going to continue through the southern border. Furthermore, there may be this temporary agreement with the new government. This new government, you know, they need to work with the United States, and I'm sure that they will try to find a way to do that. I believe the incoming likely foreign minister to Mexico will be in Washington on, I think it's Sunday. But Lopez Obrador, you know, Trump may think that he, and it has apparently said that he sees him to have kind of a Trumpian quality, and he is a self-avowed populist. Exactly. But the difference is he's also a leftist and has literally written a book about how wrong Trump is. The thing about populism is that you are then accountable to your people, right? So in this case, that is the Mexican people whom Trump has been insulting since he launched his campaign for president.
And also Mexican people who may not just as much as Trump seems to believe that this the United States or his constituency in the United States does not want caravans of people from Central America. Mexico as well does not want a caravan of people sort of sitting there at
exactly.
the border,
exactly.
Causing all sorts of humanitarian and security issues. Richard, where is the president on this? There was talk that he was going to actually close the entire southern border, which seems just economically and structurally impossible. Has this calmed down for the president, who seemed to grab on to the issue ahead of the midterm elections, and even he sort of quieted down about it? Where's the president on this?
Well, he has quieted down, but if you look at his Twitter feeds and if you look at the comments he's been making, and we have seen him often, you know, him just before taking off on Marine One, he
right.
answers more.
His helicopter, yeah.
It's helicopter. It remains the same talking points. There are a caravan of dangerous people, bad guys in there. And we see that, and he said it himself, that it's an issue that he scores points with his electorate on this very thing. He keeps believing, and he, if you look at polls here and there, that his electorate and a portion of Americans support him in being strong at the border, without getting into details how we treat children, for instance, or families and women, the pictures we saw after the tear gas were fired. So I think the president hasn't changed anything. The only good thing in whatever he said is this agreement he claims to have signed or have concluded with the new government in Mexico, the concept of catch and release, as he calls it, the people, the unauthorized immigrants coming in and being assigned a future moment in court to figure out their asylum claims, is not going to happen. I think this could appease him a little bit, and will probably, hopefully, help, because it's too easy for him to use this. I mean, we've seen it. It's easy for him to use this as a way to bring the attention somewhere else from what is happening against them somewhere else.
Right, right, right. Any struggles that he has, this is an easy issue to hold on to. But in this particular instance, very tangible. I mean, we're talking about a large number of people. And I think there is this question, Emily, about why is it that you brought up just a few minutes ago, why is it that people continue to come with these threats of closing the border, with these stories that we've heard of parents being separated from their children? There seems to be something, whether it is in Central America, some message that's either getting across or not getting across from the United States. Where can you sort of zoom out more broadly and speak a little bit about what they're running from?
Right. They're seeking asylum. The majority of them are from Central America, from Honduras and El Salvador. And they're fleeing from violence, right? So it's not just like the lure of the American dream, which I think is what we hear sometimes tell ourselves. It's also the conditions in Central America are so untenable as a living situation that they are coming or trying to come here. And by the way, some of those conditions are set up in part, you know, or exist in part because of past U.S. policy toward the region, right? And when you cut aid or cut programs that would screen asylum seekers there, as the Trump administration did, you have still more people who come here to seek asylum.
Well, and this is causing a backlog of asylum seekers at the border. Do we have any sense, Richard or Emily, of if the process of actually processing those asylum seekers, is it any way being streamlined, or is it simply getting worse?
No, it's just slowed down. I mean, we've heard that 80 claims have been considered per day,
right,
which is insignificant when you think there are 4,000 to 6,000 migrants still stuck in Tijuana on the other side of the border. So nothing has been done to make it easier. And the hope of the administration is that slowly, and you can hear this, a certain number of them, not that many, that accept to consider the options that are offered to them to go back to their country, hoping that they'll find a more secure area than where they were coming from at first. Is it going to work for the thousands of them? It's hard to believe that it will. But how long will we be able to keep them quiet on this side of the border considering what happened during the last weekend.
Right. Well, we talked about what issues the president might want to distract from, and one of those big issues, it seems, every couple of weeks, is the investigation by the special counsel Robert Mueller into Russian interference. There was a development this week. Michael Cohen, the president's former lawyer, who had been referred to another court, another district attorney's office, by the special counsel several months ago. Seemingly, Mueller had washed his hands of Michael Cohen. Now he's got a plea agreement with Michael Cohen, who's admitted to lying to Congress. Emily, what do we know? How does this affect Cohen's guilty plea? How does this affect where the investigation continues to go? And the president seems to be getting more and more nervous in his public statements as these developments have happened.
Right. So he admitted lying to Congress and that indeed he was looking into setting up a Trump Tower in Moscow after Trump had become the GOP nominee for president.
Presumptive nominee. I believe he had previously stated he had stopped before the Republican primary process
yes.
had happened, and it continued all the way up almost to the convention.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, so what this means for the investigation, and further, we learned yesterday that that Michael Cohen had spoken with a Kremlin spokesperson, or had been in communication with Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov over, you know, this plan where they would give Putin the penthouse and try to sell the other complexes to other billionaires, right? So that is not the same thing as my campaign and my people did not have communication with Russian officials.
Which is what the president has said.
It has insisted repeatedly that there's no contact with Russians, no collusion, no. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say whether or not this was collusion, but I will say that one would think that this moves the investigation in a more pointed direction, right? Like, we now have it's circling, not circling the wagons, but circling the tower.
Right. And we know from reports that the president, who just submitted questions to the special counsel, there was a big debate about whether he was actually going to sit down with Robert Mueller and answer questions. He submitted written questions. That among the written questions that that he was asked was about this specific Trump Tower deal, which, again, did not go through. But the discussions with the Russian government, which the permission would have been needed to pursue, did go on much longer than anybody had previously claimed. Richard, is Mueller trying to set a trap here for President Trump, and will he get him?
It looks like it, in the sense that what we have learned during the last few days about Michael Cohen yesterday, Thursday, and earlier in the week, about Jerome Corsi and Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, all these people
affiliated with the Trump campaign.
Exactly. So all this is coming out now that the president has, during the Thanksgiving holidays, handed in his written answers to the questions from the special prosecutor. So I think, and you can see in the president's reaction during afterwards, how he gets intense, how he's trying to justify something. It looks, I mean, we haven't seen the answers, the president's answer, but it looks like the president was asked precisely the same thing that was asked to Michael Cohen, for instance, and now they're comparing the answers, and the answers could be actually that the president, you know, we'll see, but yep. didn't say exactly the truth.
The answers may not match up. And as well, the agreement, which we don't know the details between the special counsel and Michael Cohen, also suggests that Cohen's conversations with Trump may be a fair game for Mueller to pursue, to question about a whole host of other issues outside of this Trump Tower particular issue. So we will be continuing to follow this story and all of these stories, but that's all the time that we have for this week. I want to thank Emily Tamkin, foreign affairs reporter for BuzzFeed News, and Richard Lautendresse, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard.